Hi, my name is Anthony Kousis, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the 36th Annual Remo Lupus Award. It's my great pleasure. This award was established in 1972 by Dr. Milton Terris in honor of his wife, Dr. Remo Lupus. The Remo Lupus Award is given annually under the auspices of the Mental Health, Epidemiology, and Statistics sections of the APHA to recognize an individual who has made significant contributions to the scientific understanding of the epidemiology and control of mental disorders. At present, the awards committee consists of Jane Costello, Ronald Kessler, and Ann Laird. I wish to thank the committee members for their participation and their hard work, and I think I speak for all of us when I say what a great pleasure it has been to select this year's awardee. One of the guiding objectives is to honor the high standard of achievement and excellence established by past Remo Lupus winners. These are scientists who shaped the field of psychiatric epidemiology from its early days, and those whose contributions have moved the field forward to its central objectives. Their work spans not only the development of psychiatric epidemiology, but also the spectrum of its purview, from etiology to course to outcome, from prevention to intervention to rehabilitation. To recognize the past and ongoing contributions of these awardees, and in the tradition of this ceremony, I would like to read the list of past awardees and to ask those of you who are present to stand and to be recognized for your contributions to the scientific understanding of mental health and illness. Previous Remo Lupus awardees, 1972, H. Warren Dunham. 1973, Morton Kramer. 1974, Paul Lemko. 1975, Alexander Layton. 1976, Ernest Grunberg. 1977, Benjamin Pastrmanek. 1978, Ollie Agnell. 1979, Lee Robbins. 1980, Norman Sartorius. 1981, Barbara and Bruce Derenbin. 1982, Jerome Myers. 1983, Michael Shepard. 1984, Ming Swain. 1985, Myrna Weissman. 1986, Michael Rutter. 1987, Daryl Regeer. 1988, Janice Eglin. 1989, Evelyn Bromit. 1990, Ben Locke. 1991, John Wing. 1982, R.J. Turner. 1993, Jane Murphy. 1994, George W. Brown. 1995, David R. Offord. 1996, Shepard Kellum. 1997, Ronald C. Kessler. 1998, Spiro Manson. 1999, Elizabeth Jane Costello. 2000, William W. Eaton. 2001, Dan Blazer. 2002, Kenneth S. Kendler. 2003, David Mechanic. 2004, C. Hendricks Brown. 2005, Mervyn Susser. 2006, Felton James Earls. In making its decision, the committee also recognized that in honoring the memory of Remo Lupus, we are honoring not only her science, but her commitment to the field of public mental health. She was an important advocate of psychiatric epidemiology, including playing a key role in the establishment of the mental health section of the APHA. And she was an important critic in the constructivist sense of the kind of science we conduct. She challenged herself and the rest of us to strive to improve our methodology, to develop our theoretical base, and to pose important questions. And now I want to introduce Dr. Bruce Dornven of Columbia University, who's going to introduce this year's recipient.
Well, I'm going to start with some early history. I met Bruce Link in 1974 when he took my seminar in psychiatric epidemiology at Columbia University. I've delved deeply into my records, and it won't surprise you that he got a straight A. This is record-based research. This is not faulty recall. And that was based, I noted, on both his seminar presentation and on his written exam. In 1976, he became a pre-doctoral fellow in our research training program in psychiatric epidemiology. And in 1980, he completed and defended his doctoral dissertation in Columbia's Department of Sociology. The title of the dissertation was, quote, Mental Patient Status and Social Disability, an Examination of the Effects of a Psychiatric Label. This thesis was a substantial opening announcement of what was to become his groundbreaking development of a, quote, modified labeling theory and a program of research investigating its implications. The modification is in the idea that labeling does not create the disorder, but rather it contributes to the disability associated with the disorder. In a natural extension of his work on labeling and mental illness, Bruce has expanded his theorizing to stigma and its consequences more generally. It will be of great interest to see where this thinking goes and how it will be related to his more recent work on aspects of mental illness that may be associated with violent behavior. In recent years, Bruce has also been developing with Joe Phelan their ideas about social factors that they term fundamental causes. The essential proposition of this theory, I think, can be described by the adage that the more things change, the more they remain the same. In this case, the focus is on changing resources in the context of unchanging and unequal modes of allocating these resources, especially as the resources affect health and longevity. This is an intriguing idea that has generated a variety of interesting and important testable hypotheses. It is evident, even to those like myself who knew him when, that Bruce has come a long way since his graduate student days. He is now professor of epidemiology and sociomedical science in the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He is also the director of the psychiatric epidemiology training program from which he graduated. He's director for the Center for Violence Research and Prevention, co-director of the Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Scholars Program at Columbia, and with Joe Phelan, co-director of a new center for the study of inequality. The quote A unquote grades that Bruce received in my course and in others as a graduate student have been replaced in the last 5 years by awards appropriate to these newer positions. The Leonard Perlin Award for Career Development from the Mental Health Section of the American Sociological Association. The Leo G. Reeder Award from the Medical Sociology Section of the same association. And especially, election to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. Bruce is a baseball fan, and we sometimes talk about baseball. As Bruce knows, I'm fond, perhaps overly fond for those of you who are not baseball fans, of baseball analogies. I'd like to draw one today that I think is appropriate, with apologies to those of you who think that baseball is just a game. Baseball observers sometimes apply a particular adjective to a very rare kind of baseball player. They call him, quote, complete, unquote. By this they mean that he has not one, but rather all of the skills that are so admired. He can hit for average. He can hit with power, as represented especially by home runs. He can run and steal bases. He can catch and throw the baseball. And he puts these things together to play a big part in the team's winning of ball games. There are many fine players who can do some of these things. There are very few that can do all of them. Bruce is a complete researcher in the field of epidemiology. He is one of the rare theorists in the field. Still rarer, he is a theorist who has studied measurement and statistics and can design and conduct research, the research that his theorizing demands. He has won widespread recognition for the excellence both of his formal teaching and his mentoring of graduate students and in the development of them as independent researchers. Complete players are rare in baseball. Complete researchers are rare in psychiatric epidemiology. I'd like to close by congratulating especially the committee that was wise enough to choose him for this award. And most important, I want to congratulate Bruce for winning the award. And I, like all of you, I'm sure, are looking forward to what he now will tell us about his work.
I want to present the certificate and this medal to Dr. Bruce Link.
Thank you. Well, that's just great. I think we should all go home, you know. thanks, Bruce, for that. And thanks to the committee. And hearing the list of people who've won this award, it really makes me wonder what I'm doing standing up here, to be honest with you. There's so many of you that are in the room who've won the award that I admire so much. I want to thank Bill for having nominated me, and the section for having put this on, and especially Tony Cousies for just being so wonderful about arranging everything. He's one of those people that you wish you in your life you had more time. I don't know how he does it, but he's so kind and thoughtful and in relating to me throughout my whole career that, you know, I wish I was more like that and had more time to be the way he is. I'd like to thank my wife, too, Jo Phelan. She's important in the sense that she makes anything that I do substantially better in terms of research. And additionally, she just, you know, makes me happy. And then finally, I want to return to Bruce's introduction and indicate what an honor it is to have the introduction come from him. As you could tell, he's my mentor. And for us, those of us at the Psychiatric Epidemiology Program at Columbia, he's an iconic figure. As many of you know, he has very, very high standards, rigorous. And all of his students know that, and they want to live up to those high standards. And, you know, we all find it very challenging to live up to those high standards. Very early on in my career, with that challenge lying in front of me, I figured out it would be a good thing to learn to think how Bruce thinks how he might respond to things. And other people figured out that I sort of learned how to do that. So wanting to live up to his standards, they'd come to me and they'd say, well, I'm going to present at the seminar and this is what I'm planning to say. What's Bruce going to say? And I'd stop and I'd tell them what Bruce would say, and their happy faces would get paler. And I said, no, don't worry. You know, I told you what he's going to say. Go back, think about it, work on it, get the best answer to it you can, come in, present. And then, you know, he'll say something and listen. And then next year you'll present and come back and respond again. And that's one of the biggest things I learned from Bruce. There's the high standards he gives. But in addition, there's the thing about the criticism. Criticism is really your best friend, and that's the way you finally get to as high standard as you possibly can. Now, I know that's not a good strategy here. I've made a room full of critics out of all of you. But I wanted to bring that up and say what a real honor it was. And Bruce, of course, did it in his inimitable way in introducing me. I love the baseball analogy. So now I want to tell you some about what my work on public attitudes towards mental illnesses. I want to take us back to 1950 and then move forward to research we've done that's just coming out now in 2006. Now, this is what I'll talk to you about. I'm going to talk to you about why public attitudes and public stigma are important things to understand and study, their role in help seeking, their role in public policy, and their impact on the lives of people with mental illnesses. I want to then sketch out some reasons for being optimistic about where those attitudes have been going, and some reasons for pessimism about where those attitudes are going, and then bring those forward to what we see about where those attitudes have tracked. And so we'll start by going back to 1950 when a major study was done, and then move forward to 1996 when some of us did a mental health module in the General Social Survey. And then finally, we'll be able to look at some the same survey reproduced in 2006. So we'll be able to look at a comparison of the 1996 and the 2006 General Social Survey. So just some thoughts about why it's important to study attitudes and beliefs. So medical treatment seeking for mental health problems will be facilitated to the extent that an individual and those around him or her recognize a problem, see it as a medical or mental health problem, believe that treatment for the problem will help. And with respect to policy formulation, attitudes and belief constitute a part of sort of the cultural context. They shape the way what we think problems are, how those problems should be addressed, which problems are important, which problems are more important, which problems aren't so important. And an example there about policy issues is it's probably going to take a lot of public support to deliver parity for mental illnesses with respect to insurance coverage. And then with respect to why attitudes and beliefs have important consequences for people with mental illnesses, most people think about the connection between attitudes and beliefs and then actions and discriminatory behaviors. We all know that that connection isn't perfect, that people can think things and it doesn't lead directly to behavior. But behavioral intentions are fairly good predictors of behavior, and so they're worthy of study from that vantage point. Attitudes and behaviors, though, again, are things that are around us. They form a normative context, and then people can worry that, you know, if I act in a stigmatizing way, will others disapprove of me? So that contextually it influences actions in that way as well. And then the final thing, and this is, Bruce mentioned this is one of the ways I've tried to make a contribution to understanding, is that it affects people who develop mental illnesses. And the idea here is this modified labeling theory. Very briefly, that idea says that we all grow up in our society and sort of learn what it means to have different statuses in that society, so that we know what it might mean to be a doctor, to be somebody who goes into a prison. And another status that people learn to think about is mental illness. And the idea here is that some of us grow up, never get severely tagged with a mental illness designation, never go into a mental hospital or develop a severe mental illness. And these beliefs about how people might treat people with mental illnesses are sort of irrelevant to us. They wouldn't matter to us. On the other hand, if I develop a severe mental illness and enter a hospital and get prominently designated as having done so, then I might start to worry about what other people might think of me. They might look down on me, not want to date me, not want to hire me, and so on. And this can be harmful or hurtful in several ways. First of all, I might feel bad that I've acquired a status that others might look down on. It might make me feel bad. It might also affect my behaviors. That is, I might withdraw, not venture out, not ask for a date, not ask for a job, to protect myself from the rejection I fear. And finally, people have shown, this isn't stuff I've shown, but people have shown that if you have these kinds of fears, you actually perform worse in situations where you interact with others, and so that it can hurt you in multiple ways. And this theory needed a measure about what people think, most people think. And here's some items in a measure that I developed to try to bring this modified labeling idea to test. And so there you see a few of them. Most women would not want to marry a man who has been hospitalized in a mental hospital. Most people think less of a person who's been hospitalized for mental illness, and so on. And then the prediction from this theory goes like this. Over on the left-hand side, you see you can have functioning that's good or poor, functioning in jobs, social networks, your self-esteem. And then on the bottom there is how you score on that scale of what most people think. You can either be low on it or you can be high on it. And the idea is that if you haven't been designated, if you haven't developed a mental illness, then those beliefs are really irrelevant to your functioning. They just don't matter to you at all. But on the other hand, if you have, then the more you believe that other people are going to reject you, look down on you, the more your performance in terms of functioning is influenced. And that idea we tested, and other people have tested in multiple ways with respect to unemployment, income loss, social network ties, quality of life, depressive symptoms and demoralization, delays in help seeking, and then self-esteem. So this is a way that what the public believes gets inside people who develop illnesses and has impact on them. So now let me go to thinking broadly across this long span of time, reasons for optimism and reasons for pessimism. First, let me start off, though, by pointing out that the huge changes we've had since 1950 to 2006. You know, vastly higher levels of educational attainment have occurred over that period. The population is much more educated. Media, you know, 1950, when I was born, very few people had TVs. There were no psychofilms. Of course, we didn't have the internet. The big move from institutionalization to deinstitutionalization occurred during this period. There have been enormous treatment advances with respect to pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy. And then there have been enormous efforts to educate the public that mental illnesses are illnesses like any other. And, of course, in more recent years, we've had direct consumer advertising. Now, we're not going to be able to pinpoint which one of these are driving changes. They're just things that are there. But we will find out what the message has been. We won't know exactly where it came from, but we will find out what the message has been. So here's some optimistic predictions from the point of view of a public mental health perspective. So dramatic changes in public knowledge have occurred, bringing the public much closer to the views that mental health professionals hold about mental illnesses, that they're illnesses, that treatment is needed, that treatment is effective, that people with mental illnesses are ill and not deviant, that mental illness should be treated just like other illnesses with respect to policy, for example, insurance parity, that with enhanced knowledge of causes and better treatments, negative stereotypes will wane and discrimination will be reduced. And pessimistic predictions that stereotypes about people with mental illnesses are really not getting better, they're getting worse. The media portrays people with mental illnesses as dangerous and incompetent. On TV day after day, studies have sort of shown this, and things are getting worse in that domain, not better. And in an effort to address public fears, mental health policy uses excessive coercion, and this constructs us and them, they belong there, we belong here, up and down, we're on top, they're not, distinctions that reinforce public fears. And then increasing the public's proclivity to see problems as mental illnesses attaches stereotypes of dangerousness and incompetence to the people identified as having such illnesses. So we're going to ask the following questions. Does the general public recognize mental illnesses as illnesses, attribute causes that relieve the afflicted person of blame, express optimism about the outcome of treatment, recommend policies indicating that mental illnesses are illnesses just like other illnesses, reject stereotypes of dangerousness and incompetence, and show a willingness to interact with people with mental illnesses. So we're going to characterize the early studies, especially STAR studies, and then present results from the 1996 General Social Survey study for clues as to changes between that large gap of time. So early studies, I'll just give a few of them, but I'll mention some of them. So one is Cohen and Struning's opinions about mental illness scale, which is useful, is still being used today. It's a multi-item scale, and sort of the underlying things that drive responses on those items that are in that scale are tagged as authoritarianism and socially restrictive attitudes. And then there was Nunnally's description of the stereotype of mental illness. Semantic differential with oppositely posed adjectives, and sort of the stereotype that he told us about was that people with mental illnesses are dirty, dangerous, and twisted. So the negative stereotype coming out there. And then John and Elaine Cumming, psychiatrist and sociologist team, saw this evidence coming out and said, look, we want to try to change it. They tried to do a public health intervention in two towns in the prairies of Canada, at an experimental town and a control town. Totally failed. The intervention, in fact, they sort of raised so much trouble in the intervention town that the mayor of that town asked them to stop the intervention and leave. And then they wrote a book called Closed Ranks. We don't want to have this. We're going to close ranks and keep mental illness aside from us. And then a paper that influenced, or a series of papers that influenced me greatly, were done by Derek Phillips in this era, documentation of attitudinal discrimination associated with help seekers. So the closer you got the psychiatry from doing nothing to going to a general practitioner to going to a psychiatrist to going to a mental hospital, the more you went along that continuum, the more rejection you faced. And then I want to say a little bit about Shirley Starr's nationwide study, the first nationwide study. And one of the things that she did that we've picked up on was to develop vignettes. And she developed Star vignettes. She had six of these vignettes. And here's a description of what she labeled as paranoid schizophrenia. And this was consistent with conceptions of the time. And so you can see what's here. Sometimes he thinks that people he sees on the street are talking about him or following him around. A couple of times now he's been beaten. He's beaten up men who didn't even know him because they thought they were plotting against him. Goes on to say that he beat his wife and so on. So that's one. Another one was compulsive phobic. She's doing pretty well. And then they come to some of the symptoms. However, she just can't leave the home without going back to see whether she left the stove lit or not. And she always goes back again just to make sure that she locked the door. And one other thing about her, she's afraid to ride up and down an elevator. She just won't go any place where she would have to ride an elevator to get there. And then Starr asked questions about these vignettes in 1950. And one of the questions that had play in the field was whether people thought this was some kind of mental illness or not. She's trying to get at whether the public could recognize these cases and therefore recognize mental illnesses as illnesses. And she found what people at the time thought to be extremely discouraging results. The only one that a majority identified as mental illness was the violent paranoid person with paranoid schizophrenia. All of the others were less, a third or less. The compulsive phobic one there that I showed you was only 7% of the public. So this was viewed as sort of negative evidence. Then Starr, reading her own results from this nationwide study and those of others, wrote this about mental illness attitudes. Mental illness is a very threatening and fearful thing and not an idea to be entertained lightly about anyone. Emotionally, it represents to people a loss of what they consider to be distinctive human qualities of rationality and free will. And there is a kind of horror at dehumanization. As both our data and other studies make clear, mental illness is something that people want to keep as far from themselves as possible. So if we just stop there and say, here's what we know in the 1950s, does the general public recognize mental illness as illnesses? You'd answer probably no, in large part. Attribute causes that relieve the afflicted person of blame? Well, probably not. We don't have direct evidence of that, but the context that we see would lead us to think no. Express optimism about the outcome of treatment? Probably not. We're sending them off over there. We're closing ranks. They're extruded from the community. Recommend policies indicating that mental illnesses are illnesses like other illnesses? Probably not, given the description. Reject stereotypes of dangerous incompetence? No. And show a willingness to interact with people with mental illnesses? No. But after that time, some things changed. Here's Walter Grove writing in 1982. The evidence in the 1950s would indicate that the public was ignorant about mental illnesses, had a very negative image of persons identified as mentally ill, and excluded them. Since then, there's been a massive education effort focused on mental illness, and the effectiveness of treatment has become fairly visible. And then the people repeated those star vignettes, and over time, the recognition of the star vignettes went up. So this generated some optimism. And then Crocetti wrote in 1974, wrote a book called with others called Modern Attitudes Towards Mental Illness, and wrote that former patients enjoy nearly total acceptance in all but the most intimate relationships. So that we have a picture of 1950 that we can draw, sort of a characterization, and then we can come to our 1996 General Social Survey and give evidence regarding the regarding public attitudes and see if things have changed by 1996. So the 1996 General Social Survey was a national representative sample of over 1,400 people. There are in-person interviews conducted by the National Opinion Research Corporation, and this one was funded by the MacArthur Foundation. NRC is the same research organization that worked with Shirley Starr. You see the response rate. This is a collaboration between Indiana University, so Bernice Pascasolito there, Jack Martin there, and then several of us at Columbia, myself, Joe Phelan, and Stevie, Mickey Bresnahan. What we did is we created five new vignettes that would fit DSM criteria. We did four of mental disorders and one of a troubled person to give some kind of an anchor on something that wasn't a disorder but wasn't so ugly, disgusting as a normal person. So you'll see what I mean by a troubled person in a minute. And then one of these five was randomly assigned to each individual in the study. So I'll show you these vignettes. I won't read them all. You'll get the idea. So that we had one depicting drug dependence. Now I'll point out one thing here. You'll see it right at the beginning there. It says John is an ethnicity man with an educational level. So these were varied. So it was John and Mary, or if it was a Hispanic respondent, Juan and Maria, and then three ethnicities, black, white, Hispanic, and three educational levels. And you see that John has the criteria fitting drug dependence. This is the only vignette you might see where there's any hint of violence. I'll point that out at this point. He gets angry and storms out. The next ones you'll see have no hint of violence in them. Alcohol dependence. Several of the times he has tried to cut down or stop drinking, he can't. Each time he tried to cut down, he became very agitated, sweaty, and couldn't sleep, so he took another drink. There's role impairment. Family complained hungover, become unreliable, making plans one day, canceling them the next. Schizophrenia. Things were okay, but then things started to change. He thought people were making disapproving comments and talking behind his back. John was convinced that people were spying on him and that they could hear what he was thinking. John lost his drive to participate, hearing voices even though no one was around. So these fit criteria for the disorders described. And then one of depression. Nothing can make him happy. He pushes through his days. It's really hard. Smallest tasks are difficult to accomplish. Has depressed mood, sleeping problems. Feels worthless and discouraged, so you get the idea there. Here's the troubled person. You know, while nothing much is going wrong, sometimes feels worried, a little sad, or has trouble sleeping at night. John feels at times things bother him more than they bother other people, and then when things go wrong, he sometimes gets nervous or annoyed, but he's getting along pretty well. He argues with his family sometimes, but he gets along pretty well with them. Doesn't fit criteria for any disorder. There's a few little things going wrong in his life. So that's the troubled person vignette. So we can ask in 1996, does the public recognize these vignettes as mental illnesses? So we asked, in your opinion, how likely is it the person named in the vignette is experiencing a mental illness? Very likely, somewhat likely, not too likely, or not likely at all. And this is the percent indicating that the vignette person is very or somewhat likely to to be experiencing a mental illness. And what you see there, you know, schizophrenia is highest. This might not seem like, you know, if you're a mental health professional, you're wanting people to identify these vignettes as mental illnesses, you know, maybe it's not, the percents aren't high enough for you. We thought as well, though, that maybe the public doesn't like to use the word mental illness, but they would use, and they're more, even more sophisticated than just applying that, they might apply more specific tags to the, to it. So we asked people, was it the thing that the vignette was written to depict? And there you see, you know, everybody thinks they are the thing that they're written to depict. So we asked them, do you think this is drug dependence? Yes. Do you think it's alcohol dependence, schizophrenia, major depression? Yes. So in other words, by 1996, the public is willing to describe these things in ways that would lead to help seeking. Pretty dramatic change from 1950. Then we wanted to know whether, in terms of attributing causes to these, would they attribute causes that blame the individual or blame the family, or would they see the causes as due to something else that might not lead to the blaming of the person with the condition. So bad character, chemical imbalance, the way he was raised, stressful circumstances, genetic or inherited problem, or God's will. So you can all guess what's the biggest one. It's stressful circumstances. It's the top one for every one of the conditions. So those in the stress paradigm, Bruce Dornlund, they've convinced the public that stress is very important in these in these disorders. Then just to look at them, you know, within one disorder. So here's major depressive disorder. You see stressful circumstances at the top, followed by chemical imbalance, followed by genetic or inherited, then the way you're raised, then bad character, and finally God's will. Same pattern, although elevated a bit for schizophrenia with respect to chemical imbalance and genetic or inherited circumstances. So just looking over these, you see that the person blaming, the family blaming ones are lower. You might say that the public is sort of adapted with something close to what mental health professionals would think about, stress, and biology and genetics combined to produce these disorders. So kind of a positive profile. And then what about with respect to optimism about treatment? So what you see here is how likely is it that this person's situation will improve on its own? In your opinion, how likely is it this situation will improve with treatment? So you can imagine outcomes here that would be ones that you wouldn't want to see as a mental health professional, as these things will just get better on their own, or these things, treatment can't help these things. Or you could see something different, which is what we actually end up seeing, which is a big separation between those two. So the public believes across these, the four disorders, that these things can get better with treatment, but if you just leave them alone, they're not likely to get better. There's a big gap in those bars between get better on its own and get better with treatment. And interestingly, if you look at the troubled person, which isn't a disorder, the public thinks, yeah, well, that might get better on its own. So you've seen a whole bunch of sort of positive things here that identify from a mental health, public health, mental point of view. People identified disorders in ways that would get them to treatment. They attribute causes that are not person-blaming, but rather have to do with biology and stress. And then finally, they're optimistic about treatment outcomes, and they think treatment is needed. Is everything a rosy picture? No. In 1996, we asked, how likely is it that this person would do something violent towards other people? So you have at the bottom there in the black bar, you know, sort of what they think about the troubled person. And 17% responded that person is very or somewhat likely to do something violent. But you start to read the symptoms of mental illness, even though there's nothing about violence in them, symptoms of depression, and it jumps, it's a double. It's a doubling in the percent believing. The schizophrenia, a tripling of the belief. And then alcohol dependence and drug dependence are even higher than that. And then this is desiring social distance from the vignette person, and you see the same sort of stair step. This is the, being above the midpoint on the scale, across those five relationships, acquaintance, friend, neighbor, co-worker, or in-law. And you see in the same stair step, and you might guess that a powerful reason for that desire for social distance has something to do with fear. And this slide shows that that if people think the person's going to be violent, they're much more likely to desire social distance, the orange bars versus the green bars, for each one of these conditions. For a large reason for desire for this social distance is this belief that people with mental illnesses are very or somewhat likely to do something violent towards other people. Now, we had wanted to compare directly to Shirley Starr's research, and we couldn't do that. The language was just too different from 1950 to 1996. We thought the vignettes were didn't fit modern criteria, so we didn't want to reuse them. But there was one question that we could replicate. It was an open-ended question, and there was I'll show it to you in just a minute. Maybe everybody has their heroic librarian story. We have a heroic librarian story. When we were working on the 1996 General Social Survey, we went to the National Opinion Research Corporation and went to their library and asked them for stuff about the, since it was the same survey research organization that done Shirley Starr's study in 1950, do you have anything about Shirley Starr? And the librarian, I'll never forget his name, Patrick Bova, glasses, you know, says that, yeah, you know, they were going to throw those interviews out. I took a box and I saved every tenth one of them. So they had the original surveys, and Joe and I were able to flip through them and see what was there and read them. So we Xeroxed them all, and we were able to do what I'll just tell you about. This is the question that we replicated in 1996. Of course, everyone hears a good deal about physical illness and disease, but now what about the ones we call mental or nervous? When you hear someone say that a person is mentally ill, what does that mean to you? And Shirley Starr developed all sorts of interesting, elaborate codes in response to that question. We used two of them. One of them was whether in the description the person said something to indicate psychosis. Crazy, hears voices, things like that. That was one that we used. The other one that we used is whether or not they spontaneously said something violent, that the person's likely to do something violent, mentioned violence in describing mental illness. And that allowed us to do the following study. This is Joe Phelan's work. So what you see here is in comparison 1950 to 1996, you see on the left-hand side, those are the when the person's description was indicated something that was not a psychotic disorder, very low spontaneous mentions of violence, 3 and 2%. Then if you mentioned, if their description included mentions that indicated psychosis, much higher rates of spontaneous mentions of violence. But the really striking thing, of course, is that it went dramatically up from 1950 to 1996. So for psychosis in particular, spontaneous mentions of violence have gone up. So on this particular dimension of attitudes, things look like they've gotten worse, not better. Joe's investigated a lot of the reasons for that, you know, whether it's contact with street people, was able to basically rule that out. So there's some, let's take stock of what we might think by 1996. Does the general public recognize mental illnesses and illnesses? Yes. Attribute causes that relieve the afflicted person of blame? Generally, yes. Express optimism about the outcome of treatment? Definitely, yes. Reject stereotypes of dangerousness? No, that doesn't seem to have changed. It might have gotten worse. And show a willingness to interact with people with mental illnesses is limited by a fear of violence. So that can bring us to the 2006 General Social Survey. So this is a nationwide survey that's identical to the survey conducted in 1996 that was conducted by the same survey research organization. And this was another collaboration between Indiana University and Columbia, so Bernice, Bescas, Lito, Jack Martin, I mentioned the cast of characters, to create a mental health module. And this time, NIMH funded us. And it was 1,434 face-to-face interviews of a national probability sample. You see the response rate there. This time, we only used four vignettes, but they're exactly worded exactly the same, three of mental disorders and the troubled person. And then one of four was randomly assigned to each person. We left out the cocaine dependence vignette. So what might have happened to the identification of disorders from 1996 to 2006? A fairly short, small slice of time we're talking about now. The tendency to indicate that the person was experiencing a mental illness rose slightly for each one of these conditions. If you go to the specific condition, you see basically what you saw in 1996. People are willing to accept the specific designation of, yes, it's alcohol dependence, yes, it's major depression, yes, it's schizophrenia. What about perceived causes? Stress remains high, or in terms of people thinking that stress is important, not big changes there, some little ones. What about chemical imbalance in the brain? This went up pretty dramatically. So 10% for alcohol dependence, 12% for major depression, 8% for schizophrenia, it's getting up towards the top, so you know 8% is a big part of the distance that's left over. And for even for the troubled person, you know, 14% more in 2006 than in 1996. Genetic or inherited problem, again, went up for each one of these disorders, including the troubled person disorder. These are wildly significant in terms of inference. The way a person is raised, if you're starting to think, well, you know, they're all going up and everything's going up, here you see some differentiation. And this is actually an interaction between time and the vignettes. So alcohol dependence goes up a little bit in terms of it's the way the person was raised. Major depression came down. Schizophrenia came down quite a bit. And troubled person went up a little. So here you see something that's sort of consistent with the message that families shouldn't be blamed for these problems, not the way they were raised, and it's moving in a direction that's supportive of that idea. Bad character, you don't see many changes there except for the alcohol dependence, which goes up. Major depression goes down a little bit. Schizophrenia stays just about the same. Troubled person just about the same. What about this necessity of and hopefulness about treatment? Sorry for this being a busy slide here, but what you see is for each disorder, first 1996, it improves on its own. So that's the bars that in 1996 were low to begin with. And then 1996 improved with treatment. Then 06 improved on its own. And 2006 improved with treatment. And what you see for the two major disorders, it's not that prominent, but it is there sort of, is that there's even a further spreading out. So for major depression, improved with treatment went up a little bit, improved on its own went down a little bit. For schizophrenia, it went up 3 points for improved with treatment, went down 3 points for improve on its own. And then for the troubled person, this is really interesting, the gap is widening for that. So that improve on its own went down pretty substantially, improved with treatment, but up. So that gap is growing. So now I'll tell you something about, you know, changes in what should people do. Should they go to a medical doctor? So this is the percent indicating that the described person should seek help from a medical doctor. Went up pretty substantially for every one of the disorders. Should go see a psychiatrist. Went up pretty substantially for the disorders that aren't already high, like schizophrenia, but also went up for schizophrenia. Notice that these things are happening for the troubled person as well. It's going up there. Take prescription medication over time. This is going up for all of the disorders and for the troubled person. Indicating that the government or insurance as opposed, so this is moving to sort of, is there changes in policy? The government or insurance as opposed to person themselves, their family, or charities should be responsible for the cost of medical care. And what you see here is that people are thinking that the government or insurance should be responsible. A positive change with respect to public attitudes for taking care of the people with these disorders through insurance or government. Now you might ask, well, who changed? And I can't answer that question thoroughly, but I'll give you some examples about that. So is it young people that changed, old people that changed? How general was this change? Did it happen to all of us or just to some of us? So here's with respect to chemical imbalance in the brain by education. And it's interesting. It went up for every one of these education groups. So it went up for people less than high school, people with high school education, some college, and college graduates. You're beginning to see a steeper gradient there than you in 2006 than you saw in 1996. But it seems like this affected pretty much everybody with respect to educational differences. It affected both genders. Women were sort of ahead of men in thinking that it's a chemical imbalance in the brain. They thought that in 1996. But both men and women increased. With respect to age, it's pretty much true for every age group there. And it's also interesting to stop here. We started interviewing at 18, so that's why I used the decade starting at 18. So these 18 to 27-year-olds in 1996, this green bar, become the 28 to 37-year-olds in 2006. So you can do that comparison, and those tend to go up as well. So it's consistent with the idea that something happened to all of us. Medical doctor, you see the same thing. Each education group went up for both males and females. Going to a medical doctor also went up for every age group, save the last one. That was the only inconsistent, only group where it didn't look like it went up. Otherwise, all age groups. And then, of course, we've seen all this, and you know, has this what's happened with help-seeking behavior? This is the percent of people who had 12-month disorders, who sought treatment for mental health problems in these 12 months, all sectors, using the ECA, the NCS, and the NCSR. This is reported by Philip Wang. And, you know, people are seeking more care. So these attitudes have tracked with actual seeking of more care for people who have disorders. What about changes with respect to the stereotypes of incompetence and dangerousness over this period of time? So we've seen a lot of changes that are consistent with, well, we should go get help-seeking. These are illnesses. They have a biological basis. They're genetically inherited. Does this message carry over to help with the stereotypes of incompetence and dangerousness? And pretty much this is a question about whether or not the person is able to manage their own money. And what we see here is not much change. Pretty much stayed the same. Went up a little bit maybe for major depression, came down a little bit maybe for schizophrenia, but pretty much no change over that era with respect to that. And violence, nothing much changed for the better. Pretty much the same picture. Maybe it's good it didn't get worse, but it didn't get better, even though there's been all those other positive changes. Same thing with social distance, maybe a slight decline for major depression, but otherwise not much change for the disorders. I took the three sort of, some people don't like having married in the family, in the scale. It's like, you know, no, if you read that, the disorder, some people have a hard time thinking that you'd ever say yes to that. So I limited it to the acquaintance, friend, or neighbor, so the more less intimate kinds of social distance. And you see some improvement for depression and some going in the opposite direction for schizophrenia. So are stereotypes about mental illnesses more or less prominent in the people who believe a chemical imbalance in the brain causes the vignette condition, believe that the vignette conditions are mental illnesses, or for in people who recommend treatment from a psychiatrist? So these things have changed over time, and they're consistent with the message we've been delivered. Do the people that up, I can't look at the people who uptake them, but the people who believe these things have more positive views when it comes to the stereotypes. So we'll look at a few bar graphs with respect to that question. So this is the percent believing the vignette person is very likely to be violent by whether the vignette is considered to be a chemical imbalance. So here we see that the people who, when people think it's due to a chemical imbalance, they're slightly or sometimes substantially more likely to think the person would be violent. So the change has occurred, but moving towards that belief is associated with a stronger stereotype. If it's viewed as a mental illness. So the people who view these disorders as mental illnesses are more likely to think that the cases are going to be violent. You think the person should go to a psychiatrist, the more likely they are to think that the person should go to a psychiatrist, the more likely they are to think that they're violent. Here's the stereotype with respect to managing their own money. If people think it due to a chemical imbalance, then they're more likely to think the person isn't able to take care of their money. That's true for the major depression, for schizophrenia, not so true for alcohol and depression, true for the troubled person. So viewing it as a chemical imbalance, more likely to endorse the stereotype. And here is, if it's viewed as a mental illness, substantially more likely to then also say that the person's not able to take care of their money, managing their own money. And then psychiatric treatment, the same story with respect to major depression and schizophrenia and the troubled person. If they think that they should go to a psychiatrist, then they're less likely to think that they're able to take care of their own money. So I'll talk then, in summing up, the implications of these changes from 1950 to 2006 for help-seeking, for casting a broader net to include the troubled person, and for the stereotypes. So for consequences for help-seeking, in the period from 1950 to 2006, there have been enormous changes in public attitudes and beliefs about mental illnesses and their treatment in the United States. So we go back to Starr, Cohn, and Struning, Nunning, Cumming, and Phillips. They documented a disinclination to see problems as a reflection of mental illnesses, strong negative stereotypes, strong desire to distance, to close ranks, and treatment-seeking was stigmatized and thus a last resort. But people now identify disorders in a manner consistent with medical conceptions. People have made dramatic changes in beliefs about biological and genetic causes that are consistent with the medical approach. People are much more likely to suggest medical and psychiatric contact and increased medical help seeking for such disorders over time. People have increased their support of funding for treatment through insurance coverage or government programs, and all of this is enormously positive for treatment seeking for mental health problems. But what about if we turn our eye towards consequences of casting a broader net? Changes in beliefs about causes extended to this troubled person, the person who didn't have one of the DSM disorders. So in 2006 compared to 1996, the troubled person vignette was thought more likely to be caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, thought more likely to be caused by a genetic problem, more likely to be recommended for consultation with a medical doctor, more likely to be recommended for consultation with a psychiatrist, and more likely to be viewed as a mental illness. So this could herald an expansion of demand to persons who do not have DSM disorders and whose problems are less well-defined and not as severe as people who have DSM disorders. And so this could have consequences for the system of widening the net to troubled persons. It can overwhelm demand on the system if more people are being considered as belonging in that system. And then there could be difficulties in sort of the rational allocation of resources to those most in need. If you're pairing a troubled person who's young, highly educated, and has insurance to a person who's older, depressed, and doesn't have insurance, who gets it? And then you might have, with this broader expanding net, trouble convincing insurance companies to cover mental health. What about the consequences for individuals from widening of this net to troubled persons, which might be a lot of us, There's a possibility of receiving treatment that helps. The kinds of problems that are there could be ones that you can get help for. But then more people are exposed to stereotypes of mental illness, and we haven't been doing a good job at reducing those. So what about consequences for stigma, for stereotyping and discrimination? We might have thought that a massive change from a social deviance to a medical view of mental disorders would have broadly reduced stigma. It just didn't. The best evidence indicates that the dangerousness stereotype has either intensified or remained stable in the midst of these other major changes. Similarly, inferences of incompetence have either not improved dramatically or have actually become stronger. Social distance has not appreciably changed for any of the disorders. Moreover, the beliefs that have changed dramatically, biological causes, mental illness labels, and psychiatric treatment seeking, are reliably associated with increased perceptions of dangerousness and decreased assessments of competence. So the news about these elements of public beliefs is not good for people with mental illnesses. So we've been enormously successful in changing public knowledge and beliefs about mental illnesses, but only in some domains. Core stereotypes of dangerousness and incompetence remain strong, and perhaps even stronger than they were decades ago. We cannot address these problems through the message we've already delivered, that mental illnesses are illnesses with biological and genetic causes that can be treated. Those are important messages in themselves, but they do not solve the problems of stereotyping and discrimination. And that's what I think for now. That's something that, of course, these data can't address.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and it, you know, the ideal data would either be really great psych epi data with treatment seeking well covered and the attitudes well covered. We really don't have that on a broad basis. I suppose the kind of thing that you're suggesting could be well done by studying people on their way in, but I don't have any evidence about that. Oh, you mean ask that here with in the survey?
Learning more about the experience.
Right, right. It'd be an interesting and reasonable thing to do.
The other thing we've been interested about is that from a frustration in dealing with STAR and your stuff and unfortunately and so forth, trying to figure out and asking psychiatric epic questions of people, whether they have any clue what you're talking about. You know, and so it's been interesting to take some of the same kinds of things that you take as follow on, except as the stimulus instead of it being a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Let it be pick any definition. You ever heard of the word depressed? You know what it means.
Right.
If somebody was depressed, what would they look like if somebody was depressed?
Right.
What would cause it?
Right.
And if somebody was, and then there's some
right
choices under that. And then if somebody
right
was depressed, what would you do about it? If they were in
right
your family.
Right.
Call the cops. Whatever
right
else.
Right.
And we've done some data that have looked at that, asking about depression and about alcohol.
Yeah.
Schizophrenia. And now we're going into PTSD.
That's
but
great.
But
that would have been what Shirley Starr would have done.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If she was alive now, I think she liked the open-ended questions in addition to the closed-ended questions. And that's why she asked that one open-ended one about mental illness. But if she was around now, she would have seen that the public was talking about specific disorders, and I think she would have endorsed just what you said. David, you want to?
Yeah, it's great work. Out to install other things that we don't have.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And, I mean, one thought about that was the vignettes are a little bit better than just a straight question because they give you a little more. But they still are subject to what you're saying, and that's your idea about that that what they fill in might be more serious, might make them, you know, that's definitely possible. Bill? You mean it's creating the symptom?
It's
contributing to
it.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Self-esteem and all that
right.
Pretty sociological stuff.
Right.
It's the core negative
right.
Schizophrenia that are failing to recover and could recover if there were social reinforcement.
Right.
If there were no stigma.
Right.
So I'm saying it's
right.
A stronger theory than
right. 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 Thank you. But I mean, actually, listening to the list of people who got the award, there was Ernie Gruenberg, whose social breakdown syndrome, which is might be connected to what you're talking about. I don't know if you remember that, but anyway,
sure.
Yeah.
Hey.
Well, you're giving me a blank look.
No, that was before the concept.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I would definitely want to be able to investigate that kind of thing and think it makes a lot of sense. The chemical imbalance in brain, you know, maybe everything is good. But is it, I think the idea of imbalance, and is that the way you're starting to interpret stuff? When you think, you know, why does that person have those problems? And then you think, oh, that's it. That's, well, I don't know, something like that. I'll go around this way, Bill and then Bruce. And then David.
I think it's interesting that as more people buy the notion of biological determinism or mental illness, that the perception that people with mental illness can be dangerous or incompetent has not gone down. And I think to some extent that's consistent with the way some sanity statutes.
We might actually have some questions that could investigate that in the survey, because there are some that John Monahan put in about whether or not the person could be. It had to do with commitments type stuff.
Sure.
So that is in there. So we could look at that. Bruce. Uh-oh. One thought is that the stereotype's powerful. That, you know, if someone has mental illness, they're violent. I've learned that, and I've seen that in the papers. And in some ways, there I'm wanting them to fill in, because that's what I want to study. Is, you know, what do they fill in when they read this? And then they and the result is, I think that they fill in violence. And this is, I mean, and then I think too, I mean, Irving Goffman used to study these kinds of things. That, you know, in public situations like the subway, we kind of keep track of whether things are normal, and then anything that deviates from normal catches our awareness, and you know, it could make us afraid. So you read some of the symptoms, and you say, well, this is a scary guy, because it deviates from what I consider to be a norm, a normal. It's interesting, back when Shirley Starr did her studies, there was a big debate about how to do surveys, whether you do them open-ended in code or you do them closed-ended. And the closed-ended tend to win out for surveys like this, but your responses to me are making me think, well, maybe I shouldn't do that. David? They weren't more likely to see these scenes violent. Just stayed about the same. Yeah. Right.
Ability.
not from this. I could spin yarns, but not from what I've been looking at here. On what you said before, though, about the move towards thinking is more biological. I mean, it's like, what's going away there? Well, the person controls their own behavior. They're in control versus they're out of control, maybe, kind of a thing. You, that if it's in your genes or in your biology, it's sort of going to express itself. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's a possibility. Dana. I think that's, you know, what you saw is the best I got. So what you're suggesting is kind of like to go further with that, to try to understand whether that band is narrowing. Is that what you're asking? Yeah. And what that would mean, and is that the kind of place we want to live in or not? Could be. It might not be. You know.
Then there, a higher level of deviance
No, the other way around.
That we're less tolerant of what would be considered normal variation in mood and these kinds of things, or normal variation in sort of function.
Right. So, if over here is perfect functioning, and here's something that's disabled functioning, the normal person is maybe here. Is this line switching this way? Elisa. Coursework has been done with
right. In the past, yeah.
And I mean the two things I can say about that is that someone who worked with me recently is just doing a study like this in Washington, Jennifer Stuber. And then the other thing is that when I talk to consumer group movement, this is the thing they always say. You know that. That they want me to study stigma in the mental health system. How come you haven't done that? Oh. Ginny.
I haven't done a content analysis of news stories or media or Hollywood, but it seems to me that certainly since 1950,
it's a clear possibility, and people have done the content analyses. They've done basically the epidemiology of violence in primetime TV. They watch the characters. They keep track of if they're portrayed as mentally ill or not, and whether they do something violent or not. And in primetime dramas, they're much more likely to do something violent if they've been portrayed as having mental illness. I don't know that.
Right.
Well, it hasn't gone up over time. And we have to remember, the violence hasn't gone up over time.
No.
We have to remember that in 1950, they didn't have TV. So it's a new exposure. You know, so since 1950, we knew they weren't getting any of that. Now they're, but it depends on, I'm saying, do you need to make me stop? Well, thank you all for coming.